And so you have a compass that is inside of you. Most of us just don't know how to read it. And so the fact is, you're never truly lost. You may feel lost. You may feel like you don't know what direction to head in. You may feel like your life is like a dark forest and you don't know which way to go. I am telling you right now, there is a compass inside of you. And I'm going to teach you how it works. The way that it works is that it always points in the direction of things that you're interested in, that you're curious about, or that you're energized by. That's the direction that is true north for you. I asked Amy to describe a situation where she felt energized and when her heart felt expansive. And let me take you back into the coaching session so you can listen to what she said.
One would be with my oldest son, who has gone through his own personal struggles in his life. You know, mentally, he has a lot of some of the same issues that I have had, and I have helped him, I hope, by being very open and honest with some of my own struggles and kind of walking him through how to deal with that.
Yeah.
And instead of telling him what to do, I quite often just tell him, what do you need me to do? How can I help you? This is my thought, instead of, you need to do this, you need to do that. Because he's very, apple doesn't fall far from the tree, he's a very independent guy. And he has just made a wonderful life for himself. So those are times when I have good feelings, when we have interactions like that where I can talk to him as the adult he is, but I've been helping him to grow by showing some of my own insecurities.
You feel expansive and energized when you're helping other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting because we want to deny what our inner compass is saying. It's obvious when you listen to Amy that it's those moments where she's listening and not telling people what to do, but she's counseling them. She's having a very kind of back and forth, empathetic, problem-solving kind of conversation, just like an amazing therapist would, sharing personal experiences, offering up things to think about. Now, I asked Amy this question about what it is that energizes her. When does she feel like her heart is expanding? And now I want you to think about it for yourself. What is something that you can think back on that you've done or that you want to do that really excites and energizes you, that feels like you're growing and expanding? That right there, that's the direction to head in. And I don't want you to be like Dan. Remember what Dan said when I asked him about his dream? He's like, don't laugh. Don't laugh. I don't want you to be like, oh, don't laugh, Mel, but I've always wanted to learn Spanish, or, you know, I've thought about teaching, or, boy, I've always wanted to be a painter. I just saw one of my friends that I haven't seen in a while. Our kids are different ages and our schedules are totally different. And I literally have not had a sit-down catch-up with her in probably 5 years. And I asked her how work was going, and she turned to me and said, you're going to think this is crazy. I was like, there it is again. What are you talking about? Did you rob a bank? That would be crazy. And she said, no. I'm just really tired of what I'm doing in real estate. And I have finally listened to what my heart is telling me and has been telling me for 20 years, Mel. I'm painting again. And I have applied to be a member of a bunch of professional organizations for painters. And she explained how she had to have her personal breakthrough to even start to see herself as a full-time painter. And so when you feel that tug of your heart, when you identify that it's painting, that it's teaching, that it's opening a bakery, that it's writing a novel, you might have that don't laugh. Oh, it's crazy. Screw that. Move in that direction. Because your energy levels are a beacon that will pull you out of a dark forest. And once you get into action, once you start walking, once you start wandering, you're going to learn what you need to learn in order to take the next step. Maybe you're going to hate painting class, just like I hated working for that coffee shop. That's incredibly valuable data, because now you can take painting off your list of dreams and take the fork in the trail that leads you to something else that energizes you now that you know it's not painting. For Amy, the interest that she has in counseling is like a beacon. It's like a marker on a trail. It's like a lighthouse off in the distance, and it is providing a direction to move towards. That's all. You're not signing up for a life sentence. If you don't like it, you don't have to do it. What you're trying to do is to start moving so you're no longer lost. And the direction you're going to move in is whatever your inner compass is telling you is true north for you. Because the problem isn't usually that you don't know what to do. The problem usually is that you're spinning in place. And it's the spinning in place that's triggering fear. If you were to take one painting class, or if you were to start reading a book about a topic that you're interested in, or if you were to start watching a YouTube video a day about something that you're interested in, instead of spinning, you're now moving in a direction, and moving in that direction creates momentum. And once you take action, you're going to learn a hell of a lot more than you would just standing there thinking. So I want you to tune in. I want you to find that inner compass, locate it in your heart, and pick one dream, one interest, one thing that you're curious about that energizes you, that would expand you, that would have you learn something. And I want you to take one small step forward. Remember, you're just going to move one brick at a time. And if you want a refresher on this, I would highly recommend going back to Dan's session, the very first coaching session, and listening to it again. Now, the fifth and final takeaway from this session is that unresolved issues follow you. Remember, I always say that if you change your response to fear, you're going to get control of your life. And the converse is also true. If you don't change your response to fear, you are going to be stuck in patterns from childhood forever. That would blow, wouldn't it? Your boss is going to feel like your mother or your father. Your roommate is going to feel like the mean girls from high school. If you were the outcast in high school, you're not going to bond with your coworkers. And you're going to feel like a child who's trapped and can't get control of your feelings and get ahead. And in Amy's case, can't speak up. Now, Amy's fear was triggered at her work because her boss was unpredictable, just like her mother. Remember what Amy said?
I think that that's partly what has triggered some of the more stress I've felt in the last few months.
So are you working for somebody like your mother?
Well, she has a similar personality, meaning that you're never quite sure what mood she's going to be in when you come in for the day.
Okay. That's her thing.
Mm-hmm. But I'm the person in the middle between her and the people that are underneath me or both of us. And so I'm the one trying to make sure that the people that are under us understand what they're supposed to do and feel good about their day, I suppose.
I personally think this is the most powerful takeaway from this coaching session, that she is triggered by patterns of her childhood because her boss is unpredictable, just like her mother used to be. Never quite sure what mood she's going to be in when you come in for the day. I bet you've felt that before, walking into work or working for somebody. You're never quite sure what mood they're going to be in. And Amy's pattern when her mother was unpredictable, what was it? Shout it out as you're listening. You know, it was to be silent, put on the body armor, which is why she keeps being silent around her boss. It's very simple. You did it when you were a kid. You're now doing it as an adult. And if you don't get control of this pattern, you will remain trapped and feeling like a child. Because at some point in your work life, guess what? You're going to have a boss that reminds you of your mother or your father. Whichever one it is that triggers you, they're going to be the one responsible for your paycheck. They're going to be the one that you got to interact with every single day. And let me tell you something, that boss, you can look at this as a curse or a blessing. I prefer, because I'm the kind of person that sees the bagels on the table, to see it as a blessing. The boss is in your life for a reason. It's so that you can get rid of the pattern that you're stuck in from childhood. The boss that is triggering you is an opportunity to go to work on the unresolved issues that are triggering you from whatever it is that was happening with your parents. Because there's no difference between your home life and your work life, because you are always you. And you carry your patterns everywhere you go. So you might resolve something in your love life at home with your partner, and that's great. You got to work on this stuff everywhere. But if you don't get rid of the pattern entirely, it's going to follow you everywhere. So home life now, that may be fantastic, but then you walk into a work situation and the fear gets triggered and now you're acting like a child again. You shut up instead of speaking up. You put the armor on instead of stepping out and being yourself. You turn into a chameleon to blend in instead of being you. This is why it's so important to get control and to change your response to these fears that trigger you, because your unresolved issues follow you everywhere until you do. So as you were hearing that, you're probably thinking, all right, Mel, I agree with you. Now, how the heck do I get over these unresolved issues from my childhood? Well, first of all, you can't change your patterns until you see them. So the first step, as stupid as it sounds and as obvious as it sounds, is the hardest, because it's about seeing the pattern. We're so addicted to blaming everybody else. My boss sucks. My colleagues are the worst. Because you know what? It's a lot easier to point the finger than to take a look in the mirror. And we love to blame everybody else for how we turned out. That way we don't have to see the pattern. So you're going to have to look hard and close in order to see it, because it's scary to take responsibility for your life. You know, you want to say, my mother screwed me up, my father screwed me up. And look, I'm not talking about situations of physical abuse, of sexual abuse, of trauma. I'm talking about day-to-day stuff that happens in everybody's life. When an 8-year-old brain decides as a coping mechanism, in order to stay safe, in order to be part of this family, in order not to piss off my mom who's always got a resting bitch face and is always in an angry mood, I'm just going to be silent. In order to change the pattern, you have to see it. And the fastest way to see it is to try to take responsibility for creating that pattern of behavior in order to protect yourself. You're not to blame for that, but there's a lot of power in seeing it and owning it so that you can change it. That's how you get the power. You know, as a parent, this is a really daunting thing to talk about, because Chris and I have 3 kids and they all respond to situations of fighting and conflict in our household very, very differently. And I can see as a parent, oh my God, they've created these patterns of behavior because of me. My daughter Sawyer, she gets mad and she stops talking. Our daughter Kendall, she fights back and argues incessantly whenever there's any kind of issue that she doesn't like with me. And it drives me crazy because she's just like me. And our son, I think he's a genius because he can cry on demand, which literally stops me in my tracks. So he gets everything that he wants. He's also the 3rd, okay? So, and it's the most effective of all. He gets emotional and it makes me melt. And I hope Kendall and Sawyer are not listening, because I don't need all 3 of them doing this to me. So just like my kids have patterns to deal with situations where I seem to be upset, you have a pattern in how you respond to somebody who's upset. And it's a pattern that you picked. Sawyer picked getting mad and not talking. Kendall picked fighting back with me and arguing. Oakley picked crying. And for each one of them, it's working. And they're going to keep on doing it until it's no longer working in their lives. Now, you could have picked flipping your mother off, which would have had its own set of consequences, for sure. If I had flipped my mother off, can you imagine being an 8-year-old that gives your mother the middle finger? Whoa. I've heard about kids like that. That would have had some serious consequences in my house. But who knows? Maybe it would have worked. You could have picked crying. You could have picked getting silent. You could have picked body armor. You could have picked being a clown. You know, that was my brother's. When my mother would get angry, I would shut up and get silent because I was afraid of making her more upset. You know what my brother did? He would start clowning around. And it always made her laugh. It worked like a charm. Why didn't I pick being a clown? It would have saved me years and years of therapy. Once you see the pattern, and there's no right one, there's no wrong one, it's just personal to you. What do? When somebody's starting to get pissed off, what do? When somebody's starting to judge you, what do? If you want to avoid conflict and settle things down, whatever it is, that's yours, own it. Now, second, once you see your pattern, now you may be wondering, okay, great, I'm a clown, I'm a crier, I'm silent, I flip people off, I get angry, whatever it is. Now that you see it, you may be wondering, how do I break that pattern? You do it using the simple science of updating your habits. You have to have a new pattern ready to go that you've decided that you're going to use every time the old pattern shows up. I'll give you an example to make this crystal clear. I used to suck my 2 fingers to soothe myself. That's a pattern. We also call it a habit. So if I got nervous or bored or whatever, I would stick the pointer finger and the middle finger, those two suckers right there, I'd stick them right in my mouth. And I did it so often for so many years that I eventually developed these big welts in my fingers that were totally disgusting. All the way up until I was 11, it was like having a flesh retainer embedded on my hands because my teeth had embedded themselves into my fingers. I sucked them so much. And it wasn't until I was so embarrassed that I was still doing it that I wanted to stop. So my mom and I sat down with a doctor and we came up with a list of all the times I wanted to suck my fingers, sitting on the bus, watching TV, in bed at night to fall asleep. And then we came up with a couple of new patterns that I would do instead of sticking my fingers in my mouth. On the bus, I would chew gum or sit on my hands. When I was lying on the couch or in my bed at night, I wore mittens. And eventually, the new pattern overrode the old one. Now, the same is true with the patterns that you have that you reach for when you're afraid of disappointing somebody or you're afraid of getting in trouble. And if you change your response to fear, what have I told you? You're going to take control of your life. So if you go silent when you feel afraid, the new pattern, always speak up. And when you start to feel triggered, like you're about to be silent, just sub in the new behavior, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, interrupt the old pattern, and then speak up. It's that simple. And it works for any single behavior you want to change. Rather than aiming to get rid of the behavior, simply have a substitute for it ready to go. Now let's sum up Amy's 5 takeaways for you. First, in order to get control of your life, you have to understand what you do when you feel afraid. Amy's massively afraid of conflict because of how she was raised. Her mother yelled at her and then she'd give her the silent treatment. And so Amy, as a result, avoids conflict or getting yelled at or getting in trouble by staying silent, putting on the armor, especially at work. Second major takeaway is to understand that your physical response, and we talked a lot about this in Amy's episode, your physical response to fear, it's encoded in your nervous system. It's almost like alarm bells going off. But you can change the way that your nervous system responds to situations. You can change these patterns so that they don't stop you anymore and so that you can take control of your life. Now, even though Amy broke out in hives, even though her stomach was fluttering, that's an automatic response by her nervous system. She went in and talked to her boss's boss anyway. You see, you can feel out of control and still take control. That's a major, major takeaway from this. You can feel out of control, and you will when you start to change, but you can still take control. And the same thing's going to happen to you. So expect it and do it anyway. Third takeaway, super important to recognize when you're being a chameleon and hiding in plain sight. You may be doing it just to keep the peace, or maybe you're doing it to blend in, or maybe you're doing it to try to get a guy to like you like I did. It's triggered by fear. The fear of not being good enough, the fear of being rejected. And the hardest thing that you're going to face if you're a chameleon is to trust that you're enough. It's in that moment when you reach for the lie or you reach to blend in that you find the courage to be you, to say what's true for you, to show up as you. The fourth takeaway, if you feel utterly stuck with zero clue about what direction to turn to figure out your career, I want you to revisit the concept of your inner compass and the way that your inner compass works and is always guiding you and pointing toward your true north, which are things that you're curious about or energized by. You're never, ever lost. You just have to read the compass and then start marching in its direction. And finally, unresolved issues follow you. If you don't take control of these patterns, they will follow you everywhere, especially at work. And if you want to move past these patterns, if you want to reach your potential, if you want to be happy and have more joy and fulfillment, you have to first recognize them. And then you're going to use the science of habits to substitute the pattern with a new behavior. Because your unresolved issues will follow you everywhere. But if you change your response to fear, you will take control of your life. In this final coaching session, we're going to talk about something we haven't touched on yet. And that's how your childhood experiences and the patterns that you develop in reaction to them impact your ability to have a healthy and successful romantic relationship. Now, for those of you who keep finding yourself in one failed relationship after another, and you can't seem to figure out how to make one work, this is going to be a life-changing conversation for you to listen to. That's because we're going to be discussing and revealing that most relationship ruts, they don't have to do with the person you're with. It has to do with the patterns that you've developed that are getting triggered by the dynamic with the person that you're currently with. And you just can't see it. If you grew up in a traumatic household, like the one our next guest did, you will also likely learn that your idea of love is totally warped. And right now, if this doesn't apply to you, you're in an intimate relationship, it's totally fulfilling, this is still a very important coaching session to listen to because you're going to discover that you too have patterns from your childhood that you have carried into your relationship. And healthy and successful relationships require you to be vulnerable, whether they're thriving or they're tanking. And for many of us, vulnerability, that's terrifying. And after 5 coaching sessions, you know that when you feel vulnerable or afraid, you automatically resort to patterns that you may not even see right now. And I'm telling you, it is impacting your relationship. So if you want to improve your relationship, and I mean, who doesn't? Who doesn't want to be more deeply connected and in love? To do that, it's essential that you figure out where you still feel vulnerable and afraid and you change your response to it. Because when you change how you show up in your relationship, when you show up with courage and when you show up more fully, you will take control of your life. And one more thing. In Amy and Heather's coaching sessions, you heard them describe what it was like to grow up in a tense household. Well, the woman you're about to meet, she grew up in an abusive one. And some of this coaching session may trigger you if you did too. Now, let's meet Cassandra.
My name is Cassandra, and I'm from Bremerton, Washington. I am not married. I do have 3 kids, ages 13, 9, and 4.
So tell me about your biggest fear.
My biggest fear is that I don't know how to have a functional, committed relationship with a man. And so I just keep kicking him out of my lives. And now I've got a really great one that I would really love to hold on to. And I find myself redoing the whole pattern. Like, I can see it happening now.
Describe the pattern for me.
So the pattern would be, you know, things are going great for a while and then we get comfortable with each other. And then I start like nitpicking, like noticing like just stupid stuff. Like, you loaded the dishwasher wrong. So now I got to redo it.
I thought all, you know, people we date and love load dishwashers wrong. No?
They probably do. Okay. I don't know if it's just me or.
Do you think he's doing it on purpose?
Oh, no, not at all.
Yeah. Let me ask it again. Because I just realized I asked you the intellectual question. Have you told him how you want it loaded?
I've showed him a couple of times. And I've tried to keep it to a minimum because I know nobody's going to do it how I want it done, right? And so I kind of have to give everyone some grace, and that's fine. You know, but that was just one example. It's like either that or, you know, he sleeps until 10 a.m. 3 days a week. Or, you know, and I'm up at 5:36 doing my thing. And I have to understand that he's not me. He's his own person, and he does his own thing, and he works late at night, and he maybe wants to sleep in, you know? And so I catch myself just finding stuff to be angry at him for. And it bothers me because he's really great. And I know that if I keep it up, I'm going to push him away. If I keep it up, he's going to have enough and be like, I love you, but I don't need this, you know? And then I'll be fine. Good riddance. You know, I didn't want you around anyway, or just some garbage. But, you know, that's what I've always done. And so, and I've always survived, and I've always done well for myself. And so I don't know.
You used an interesting word mm-hmm. when you described your biggest fear.
Mm-hmm.
You used the word hold on to.
Mm.
And in using the word hold on to, the immediate image that came to mind was that somebody's leaving or somebody's moving away, mm. And now you have this pattern where you hold on to their leg as they're walking out the door, leaving you, yet you're also the one pushing them out the door. And you've just told me, I'll survive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've always done well for myself, Mel.
Yeah.
This pattern of pushing people away and clinging to them, it's a classic pattern when you have fear of abandonment. And we're going to go get to the bottom of it so you can see the pattern, so you can get control of it. So let's start by you telling me about your parents' marriage, because you didn't make this pattern up. You learned it from somebody.
That was awful. It was horrible. My dad was an alcoholic, and he drank pretty much from the time he got home, which was usually like 7 o'clock at night because he'd go to the bar after work.
Mm-hmm.
So he would come home with a 12-pack and drink the whole thing and set up shop out in the garage. He had this huge workbench in the garage, so he'd just be out there smoking his cigarettes and drinking his beer, just isolated from everybody. My mom and my sister and I would just go about our lives, but he and my mom fought constantly. Like, they didn't get along on any level about anything. And so it was just constant screaming, constant fighting. Every now and then, my mom would get so pissed off that she'd leave, you know, and she'd go drive the car for a couple hours and come back. But I remember being so small, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, and she would do that. And I would just be like, my mom is gone forever. Like, that's it. I'm never going to see her again. And I was terrified. And she'd come back and everything would be fine. But it was like, for those couple hours, it was just devastating. And my dad, I remember having to go over to the neighbor's house because my dad was too drunk to take care of us, you know, every now and then. And it was just, you know, and he got a temper. He would throw furniture off the deck. He would punch holes in the wall. I remember, I think it was the bathroom door had a hole in the wall, or hole in the door, sorry, from that. And, you know, just terrifying. He never hit my mother, but he would hit my sister and me. So he was physically abusive with us and just verbally abusive to everybody. And so he was in the Air Force till I was 11. And then he took a job where he would travel a lot. Mm-hmm. So he'd be gone.
What was the house like when he was gone?
Peaceful. Lovely. You know? And we didn't have to. There was just, my mom was like, she's like my oak tree. You know what I mean? She was steady. She was always there. She was loving, nurturing, amazing. Right. And so when my dad was gone, she was even better because, like, she didn't have to deal with his garbage, you know. And then he'd come home, like, every 6 weeks or whatever and fight, whatever, until he left again. So one time he came home and I was 13 and they got into a fight and he came into my room and he said, I think it would be better if I stayed somewhere else. And he left. And I didn't hear from him for a month and a half. And since then, I've probably seen him 5 times. He just left, like completely split off the grid. And I remember feeling so relieved. I'm like, thank God, the fighting's going to stop. Because I already knew we could survive. Like, we'd done it, and he'd been out of town and whatever. But yeah, it totally just split, left the family, whatever. And so, you know, looking back, it's like I mentioned how, like, my mom was like the nurturer and the oak tree and everything. And she was like unconditional love 100% of the time. And I know my dad loved us, but he just never showed it. He was just never sober enough to, like, say, I love you, you know. But I find that as a child, I craved his love more and I craved his attention more because I felt like I had to be like, Dad, I'm right here. Look at me. Love me, you know. And I never got it. And I think that that just embedded, and I carried it all the way through my adulthood, you know. To this day, my mom is still my best friend, and my dad is somewhere in Texas.
Did he ever sober up?
Mm-mm.
Did he get a new family?
He remarried, but at that point, he was, like, in his 50s. So, no new kids or anything. So, you know, and that part of it, like, never bothered me. Like, you know, cool, do your thing, get remarried, whatever. But it
does bother you, though.
It bothers me that my sister and I, weren't important enough to him to let us know. Like, we found out after the fact, you know. And my sister has she has her own take on this whole situation.
Which is what?
She wasn't home when my dad left. So she thought he left because of her, because she didn't get the goodbye, you know. And he never calls and he never writes and he never whatever sees us. And so she took that very personally. So she ended up hating men and she married a woman. Like she totally 180, you know. And she won't talk about it with me or my mother, you know. Anytime we try to bring it up, she's, you know, and we haven't made that attempt for like years. But it was very much cut us off. Like, I'm not talking about that. No, absolutely not. You know, and she would get angry with us. And now she's 38 and, you know, no kids, whatever. She has a dog. She's happy. She's cool. You know, she's successful. She's, she does really well and never talks about it, you know? So I'm sure
that's a problem.
Yeah. She has her own issues with that. I'm sure that none of us can reach, but it did kind of draw a wedge between her and I. Here I was like, you know, let's talk about it. Like, let's get to the bottom of it and try to help each other and everything. And she was like, absolutely not. I don't want to. And she and I actually parted ways for a long time. But I think she kind of turned into like a very selfish individual. You know, she didn't want kids, none of that. She won't ever have kids, which is fine. And, you know, if you're selfish and you know you don't want kids, like, please don't have kids kind of thing, you know. But she's very selfish. She's very like, I know what I want and I'm going to get it kind of thing. And, you know, whatever.
Well, okay. So thank you for sharing all that. There's mm-hmm. a lot.
Yeah.
Have you been in therapy?
No.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
You have a very succinct and well-articulated explanation for what happened. And you're also completely emotionally disconnected from it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to focus on your dad and your mom.
Okay.
But the collapse of your relationship with your sister,
mm-hmm.
particularly how judgmental you are of how she processed things,
mm-hmm.
I think there's a direct correlation to the way that you treat your sister and the way that you're treating the men in your life.
Hmm. Interesting.
And the other thing that I just want you to consider is that she might be with a woman
mm-hmm.
because she found the strength to actually be her full self. And that's who she's attracted with. And, you know, for some people, not choosing kids is the right choice. And I agree with you that if
100%,
you're, but there's a judginess about how you describe it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because you're hurt.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That she also left.
Yeah.
She didn't leave you physically, but there are choices that she has made
yeah.
that you don't understand. You understand them intellectually, but in your heart, it feels like a major disconnect. And I only put that out there, not because I think it's the core piece. I think it's another example of how you look at what's wrong and how you pick and test at people.
Mm-hmm.
On people that you love, almost like this, if I push you away,
right,
will you come back?
Interesting.
And only when you come back do I know that you love me.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the other thing about your story that really struck me is it was when your mother left that you were devastated.
Mm-hmm.
Not when your dad did.
Right.
And I don't know what the answer is yet, but I think we're going to have to dig into whether or not this is truly something related to your dad, or if this has to do with the fear that you felt very intensely when your mom left.
Okay.
For just those few hours.
Yeah.
And obviously, when you and I are talking about it and, you know, look, she's married to a drunk, abusive alcoholic who punches holes in walls and throws shit off the deck.
Yeah.
Anyone can understand that you need to remove yourself from that situation.
Right.
But what you don't understand when you're little is the fear that you feel
mm-hmm.
when the one person that you love is not there.
Right.
And that's why the holding on thing struck me.
Okay.
Because you don't give a shit that dad's gone.
Right.
You wish it had gone another way, but it didn't. And I think you understand that he's an alcoholic and he's not capable.
Right.
Of giving you what you needed.
Mm-hmm.
But the holding on to, I think, has more to do with your mother.
Okay.
I don't know. We're going to get there.
Yeah, let's get there.
Do you remember when that moment that your mother first left for those few hours to get out of the house?
We would watch her walk out the door.
Whoa. What did it feel like seeing the person that you love, your rock, your oak, like go right out the door?
It was anxiety.
Okay.
And even now talking about it, my ears are getting hot.
My face gets hot when I get anxious.
Yeah. So
where else do you feel it in your body?
My anxiety is right here.
Between, like in your chest, like right in your ribs?
Like right in the xiphoid process, like right there.
I don't know what the hell that is.
It's right at the bottom of your sternum.
Okay, pressure.
It feels nauseating.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's where I hold on to it right there.
Okay, and then it travels up and your ears get hot. Okay, so she would be leaving and you would have this feeling.
Yeah, and even though she said, I'll be back, it was like, really? When? You know, like in 5 minutes? Next week? Like, when are you coming back?
Did it happen often?
I remember it happening like maybe 3 or 4 times. And then, you know, as we got older, Dad was home less and less. And so there was less to fight about. So she wouldn't leave or whatever.
Was he worse when your mother was around?
Yeah. I think he just really despised my mom. And I don't know why. Like, I don't know the foundation of their relationship.
Can you describe like a time when you were like really afraid of him?
He was in a rage. He was, you know, seeing red, and he was mad at me for something, and I was running from him down the hallway, and at the end of the hallway was a bathroom. And I remember going into the bathroom and trying to shut the door and lock it because he was literally chasing me. I was like 8 years old. And he flung the door open, and I was behind the door on the wall, and he went to go hit me, and I crouched, and he hit me right in the stomach.
Yeah.
But when we were younger, like elementary school age, I remember the school finding out. My teacher found out, or somebody found out, and they wrote him a letter. You know.
Did you have bruises? Is that why they found out?
I would have marks. I would have like handprint shaped welts, you know.
So this isn't that he spanked you. This is
Way beyond.
This is illegal, severe child abuse. I'm glad he left the house, because there's no doubt that this has impacted your relationship with men, because you are a victim of severe child abuse and your body remembers it. This is trauma. And you relive it in ways that you aren't even aware of, particularly in the dynamic in your relationships. So who's the first man that you were ever in a serious relationship with?
So my first marriage was actually, we eloped.
Okay.
It lasted 6 months.
Did you want it to work out?
Yeah, I did. I had this big romantic idea about, you know, being married and being in a relationship and playing house and all this stuff. And he thought of it differently. He was never really fully committed and, was fooling around and stuff.
I mean, it must have hurt at the time.
It did. Oh, absolutely. And it was with his high school girlfriend, and they like never stopped seeing each other kind of thing. And he wasn't going to let a marriage stop that, you know?
Did you know?
I found out, his best friend told me.
But did you know beforehand? Did you have a
probably,
feeling?
Yeah. I probably did. Yeah.
Okay.
Because he talked about her all the time.
Okay. So the reason why I want to start to also tease out the what you knew and what you didn't know and the intuition piece is because your biggest fear is that you're going to push someone you love away. Your biggest fear is that you are going to be alone. And a lot of times when you have a string of relationships that you look back on that didn't work out, you can start to have a story that you can't trust yourself.
Mm.
Do you feel that way?
Yeah.
And I want to slowly also prove to you that you know, but you don't listen to yourself. So when
you are
falling in love
with
somebody and all he's doing is talking about his high school girlfriend and your intuition is firing off, you don't listen to it.
Right. I didn't.
At all. So I want to distinguish between moments of knowing versus moments where fear takes over, and the fear is, I don't want to lose this guy. Like, I'm feeling something, I'm going with it, mm-hmm. I'm afraid. Like, that the thought of him, when I think about him with his girlfriend, then my anxiety kicks in and I get hot in the ears and I start to get afraid. And so I'm going to hold on, mm-hmm. even though my instincts are telling me otherwise.
Okay.
So I want to draw that distinction between instincts that are informing you about what you know is true versus fear that becomes a visceral thing. Because one of the things that I believe about fear is that we talk a lot about the shit we're afraid of, right? I'm afraid of being alone. I'm afraid of pushing somebody away. I'm afraid of ruining something. I'm afraid of... But the thing that you don't realize, particularly since you experience trauma, I think you probably have PTSD. We talk about it with our armed services a lot, mm-hmm. and we think of it as something that people only experience after they've witnessed war. Mm-hmm. A lot of people witness war and trauma in their own houses. Yeah. They experience it in their bodies. And because fear is about your visceral response to change, to rejection, mm-hmm. to harm, to uncertainty, particularly in your case where you literally were a victim.
Okay.
And we're going to come back to the subject of trauma and to PTSD in particular in just a minute. But I really need to understand your history with men. So who was the next man that came into your life?
The next person was my first daughter's father.
Okay.
And he and I met in the Navy.
Okay.
We were on a ship together. And we had been dating for like a year and a half, I guess, and decided to get married. And we got married in September of 2004. And our daughter was born in November of 2004.
Okay.
And then we were married and, you know, new baby and this whole thing. And then my world turned to being a mother. And this is like my only purpose in life now. You know what I mean? And to him, I was like I didn't want to be affectionate with him. I didn't want to sleep with him. I was like, you gross me out. I want my daughter, you know? And my husband at the time was so not supportive. He was an asshole. He didn't drink. Like, he wasn't an alcoholic or anything, but he was physically abusive, you know?
I don't know. What did he do?
I tried to leave with my daughter, and I wasn't leaving permanently. It was just like my mom, like, I just got to get out of the house, right? And I had my keys, and he pinned me down with my knees up to my chest, like his full body weight on me. And he's a big guy. He's like 6'3", 200 pounds, you know. Full weight on me, pinned me, and pried my hands open with the keys. And as he was getting the keys out of my hand, he scratched my neck, like right here. So I had this huge scratch on my neck. And I'm going to work the next day. And everyone's like, oh my God, what happened? You know, and I'm like, it was my cat, you know. Like, what am I going to tell him? That my husband pinned me to the ground and pried my hand open to get the keys out?
Maybe.
Right. I worked in a restaurant. It would have just gossiped like wildfire. So.
Maybe not. No, I'm serious.
Yeah. Well,
the thing is that you're a master at hiding.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a protection mechanism.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So alcoholics are liars.
Mm-hmm.
And your dad, his version of alcoholism was also abusive.
Mm-hmm.
And you did everything you possibly could to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Especially now hearing that you had a physically abusive husband.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt in my mind that you have PTSD and that you live on edge that someone's going to hurt you.
Yeah.
It's not even about leaving.
Right.
This is about somebody hurting you. And as weird as this sounds, when your fiance today doesn't stack the dishes in the dishwasher the way that you want him to, you're feeling like the anger piece come up.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually think if we really unpacked it, it reads more like he's hurting you because he knows you've asked. Mm-hmm. You've showed him how to do this right, and he's doing this on purpose, and there's something that feels dangerous about that.
Interesting.
Because I guarantee you, particularly with this prick that put his knees on your shoulders and scratched your neck with these keys and wouldn't let you leave, mm-hmm. there's a taunting to abusers.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, it starts with the bickering and then it's like they bait you into it.
Yeah.
Into the fighting. And then next thing you know, you're getting hit.
Yeah.
Does that sound familiar?
Incredibly manipulative, you know. So like when you kiss and make up, it's all like, you know, I'm so sorry, it won't happen again, blah, blah, blah. And then later it happens again. And it's the classic abuser mentality. Well, if you hadn't done that, then I wouldn't have had to do that.
Yeah.
You know,
it's all your fault.
Yeah. All my fault.
All your fault. If you had just had dinner ready.
Yeah.
If you had not been a smartass.
Yeah. Anything. Could be anything.
And your upbringing was watching a man treat a woman that way
right.
and getting the shit kicked out yeah. of you. And so...
So no wonder we were together, right?
Well, you know why? It's because the patterns feel familiar.
Yeah.
And a lot of us are attracted to what feels familiar,
yeah.
even though we desperately want to escape it.
We want to break the cycle.
But I bet that there was a moment mm-hmm. before you got married where you're like, I don't know.
There was. I'm sure there was. But, you know, I was committed. We can make this work. Right. I can do this. I want this. I want the family unit. I want like everything to be happy and normal, like the TV shows and, you know, all that stuff.
Tell me about how you left him and what did it feel like in your body when you did?
So I had, you're going to love this. I had a vacation coming up. I was going to go fly to California to be with my mom. And we were living in Western Washington at the time. So it was just a quick 2-hour flight. And, he got it. So the night before that, he got drunk, pass out drunk, and he blacked out. And we had been fighting in this whole, it was just like my mom and dad, right? And so he passed out drunk. And instead of going to sleep and catching my flight the next day, I packed up my car, packed up my daughter, and I drove all night long to my mom's house. 12-hour drive.
Good job.
Yep.
And did you ever talk to him again?
Oh, yeah. We still talk. Well, we share a daughter, you know, and he lives out of state now. And so the only time we talk, it's a quick like, hey, I'll meet you there at noon kind of thing. It's not like we don't have conversations. But yeah, we had to, you know, I was needing people to not like, I'm a people pleaser. And so like, I get really upset when people are not happy with me.
Well, of course, because you got the shit kicked out of you when they weren't.
So
do you realize this is a survival mechanism? You're not a people pleaser.
Mm-hmm.
Your life depended upon pleasing your father.
Yeah.
It's a safety issue. For some people, people pleasing is like something you develop kind of as a personality trait. Mm-hmm. For you, it's a survival mechanism. It is hardwired and it had to be.
Yeah.
So he leaves. Or you get divorced, you leave, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the next relationship?
The next relationship is my other two children's father.
Okay.
We were together for 7 years.
Okay.
Long time. And
any abuse?
No physical abuse.
Emotional?
Yeah, there was some emotional abuse. Like if we were in a heated discussion, having an argument or whatever... I would approach him with something like, I'm not happy with the way that you talk to me because you're belittling and you, he was like the first person I was able to stand up for myself to.
Okay.
You're belittling me, you know, you're making fun of me because of X, Y, or Z. You know, as soon as I started real estate, he was like, the job sucks. And, you know, I was working 2 jobs at the time and he wasn't willing to do anything to help bring in more income so that I didn't have to work 2 jobs. I got an apartment and
you didn't tell him.
I didn't tell him. And I waited for him to go to work one day and I had a U-Haul reserved and I had.
Jesus, you do what your mother does.
Right? I had
every single one of these.
Every single time. Yeah. Waited for him to go to work and I moved out because he wasn't going to let me leave because my feelings didn't matter. Because what he wanted was important. The family unit and...
By the way, this is your relationship with your sister. Hmm. That's why you're calling her selfish.
Yeah.
because she makes you feel like your feelings don't matter. And you probably make her feel like hers don't.
Probably.
So tell me about the new relationship, the fiance.
Yeah. He and I, we've actually known each other for about 12 years.
Okay.
But at the same time, he's got more issues than I thought he did.
What are the issues that he has?
He drinks too much, I think. And, you know, he doesn't get abusive when he's drinking, which is awesome. But
That's sort of a low bar, by the way.
It's not getting abusive. You're not abusive. Put a star by that. No, you're right. That's a very low bar.
Can I stop you right there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's just focus on the issue of drinking.
Okay.
My concern is the alcohol alone triggers a lot about your childhood.
Okay.
And so if he has a drinking problem, which means he drinks more than he should, and he cannot stop himself from coming home at night and having drinks as a way to blow off the steam, it immediately creates a situation where you are triggered because you don't know what's going to happen as the evening goes on and the drinking progresses. And so it puts you on edge.
Yeah.
Which then creates the entire dynamic that I guarantee you saw your parents have and that you had with your abusive ex-husband, which is the baiting.
Yeah.
And the picking. And then the responding. And then the escalation. And I'm not blaming the alcohol.
Right.
But it is a extraordinarily scary situation, in my opinion, that you're putting yourself in. Because it's triggering all of that stuff that you don't have control of, that's inside of you.
Okay.
And so the reason why you're in this trap has to do with this primal, visceral fear of losing control. And when you were a kid, you had to be hyper aware because you were in a very dangerous situation. And it started with your dad drinking, and then you saw the picking with the parents, and then you saw your dad get violent, and then he was abusive towards you and probably abusive towards your mom, whether you remember seeing it or not. And so it's getting triggered in your adult life. The reason why you pick at him is not because you actually give a shit about the dishwasher. It's because you're living in a state as an adult woman where you are triggered by the ghosts of your past. And this is a survival mechanism. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
What are you thinking about right now?
How to make myself know that I'm in a safe relationship and to stop treating it like I need to be in survival mode all the time. Like I need to be safe. Like maybe I feel like I'm not safe even though I am.
Well, the thing that I want you to realize is that the drinking and the level of drinking that he's doing, and I don't know how much it is or not, there's something about it that's triggering you.
I would agree, because really that's the only time I'm on edge around him at all is when he's drinking.
What does he drink?
He'll have wine. Okay. Or if he's drinking liquor, it's vodka.
Okay. So is it drink one? Is it drink two? Is it drink three? Is it when you hear the ice hit the cup? What is it that makes that tingling in the back of your head happen?
It's drink one. It's when he pulls the bottle of wine out of the bag and puts it on the counter. Like I hear that noise from across the house. You know what I mean? And I'm just like, hair stand up, like the whole thing.
Correct.
And I would like to just throw in that I drink too. You know, we'll have a glass of wine together or whatever, but it's like the whole time I'm just like, why is he drinking? But I'm drinking. You know what I mean? So I don't know how to approach that because it's like, does that make me a hypocrite? You know?
And no, you know what you are? You're somebody that has PTSD. And the sound of a bottle being pulled from the shelf where you store your liquor is such a trigger because of the trauma you experienced, that what happens is before you even hear it and process that that's a bottle, as that sound of that bottle is lifting off the shelf, the hair on the back of your head is already standing up. There's tons of research about this. And in fact, a great analogy is, you know how you see the lightning before you hear the thunder? Literally, that sound is the lightning, right? And that's when the electric, like the hair stands up on the back of your head. And it's so visceral because of what you experienced as a kid. Uh-oh, dad's drinking now. I've got to be alert. I got to be the good girl. I got to make sure. I've like, he's getting another one. And you're drinking as an attempt to try to be cool with things. And because drinking can be fun and, you know, you want to feel like you're normal and you can have a glass of wine.
Right.
Totally get it. But what is going to happen unless we change some things right away is this visceral response in your body, which is driving you into nitpick protection mode, hyper aware mode, will drive him away. It's going to destroy it.
Yeah.
How is it destroying it already? What's happening?
Maybe sometimes I feel like I'm queen bee and I'm better than you and screw you, I can do it anyway, you know, the kind of thing. But he will tell me, he's like, don't talk to me like that. He goes, I'm not a child. I'm not one of your kids. And he goes, I love you. I'm going to marry you, but you need to knock that shit off.
Let's think about it like a trigger where we flip a switch and you go from just being go with the flow. I'm happy. I'm in love.
So
vodka comes out, clunk, clunk, clunk with the ice, glug, glug, glug with the vodka. Bottle goes down.
Yeah.
Switch flips inside you. Who do you become?
I become like this robot. I'll go in there and I'll have this like dialogue of questions like, so rough day, what's going on, you know? And, oh, you know, just a rough day at work or like whatever he has to say. It could be nothing. It could be 2 o'clock in the afternoon and he wants to watch a motorcycle race or whatever.
Right.
He just wants to chill out. And I'll be like, you know, there's no reason to be day drinking at all, ever. Like, you should never be day drinking. Like, drinking is for when the kids are in bed and you're watching a movie and you're chilling out. And that's my definition, right? It could be different for him, but to me, in like, in my opinion, if he has to day drink or if he wants to day drink, whatever the difference is, that's a problem. And so,
of course.
So I'm like, why are you drinking? What is the problem? You can't control yourself. And just like snowballs from there. And, you know, eventually he will either excuse himself and go outside to avoid an argument or whatever. He'll go have a cigarette or go work on the motorcycles or whatever. But then I'll follow him and I'll be like, you know, like chasing him out the door. And I'll be like, what's, you know, and it'll, and then I'll find something else to be, you know, and then you're walking away from me. What? You can't have a conversation. You can't like look me in the face. And he's like, I don't want to. He's like, look at you. Why would I want to talk to you right now? And it just escalates from there. It's not like he's on purpose, you know, but it's just like passively pissing me off with the drinking and stuff.
He doesn't understand the landmine he stepped on.
No.
See, that's the breakthrough. When you're somebody that is consumed by fear, and I want you to consider that at least in the dynamic as it's playing out in your relationship, it's not the fear that somebody's leaving, because I think you already assume that people are, that he's going at some point.
Right.
If I questioned you and you were honest with me, you would admit that you don't think this is going to last.
I've already thought in my head, like, well, when he leaves, I'll just sell the motorcycles and I'll sell all the gear. And, you know, blah, 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 blah. So that I know what's going to happen either way, you know?
All about survival, all about protecting yourself. And the problem is there's no love. That's what's missing. There's no trust. There's no intimacy. There's no love. Like there may be amazing sex, companionship. But the stuff you really want, you don't have any of that. Because you won't let it in.
So how do I do that? I want to do that. I don't know how to do that.
First of all, you got to remove the landmines.
Okay.
It's not fair to be in relationships with anybody and have emotional landmines out for people to step on. You've set this field full of things that could explode, and then you sit back and you cross your arms and you're like, all right, let's see if you can get across this. And he has no idea the extent to which this scares the shit out of you.